You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2018 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up...
A few weeks ago, in a great intelligence achievement, Israel obtained half a ton of the material inside these vaults. And here's what we got.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accuses Iran of lying to the world about its nuclear program during an extraordinary televised presentation of 100,000 stolen files. My guests today, John Everard and Carol Walker, will assess how much weight it might give Donald Trump's apparent plan to scrap the Iran deal. Also ahead, the politics of immigration.
What the British people voted for on the 23rd of June was to bring some control into the movement of people from the European Union into the UK.
We'll consider the delicate task of communicating an immigration policy without inflaming racial tensions. And when you're in the grip of a multi-billion dollar business deal, we'll reveal which musical number you definitely shouldn't be caught performing. That's all to come here on Midori House. And my guests on today's programme are Carol Walker, former political correspondent for the BBC, and John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, amongst others. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Iran lied. They were the words written in enormous text illuminated behind Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during a pretty dramatic televised presentation in Tel Aviv. Here's some of what the PM had to say.
A few weeks ago, in a great intelligence achievement, Israel obtained half a ton of the material inside these vaults. And here's what we got. Iran was faced with mounting pressure in 2003. You remember that? That was following the Gulf War. So it was forced to shelve Project Ahmad. But it didn't shelve its nuclear ambitions. So Iran devised a plan to do two things. First, to preserve the nuclear know-how from Project Ahmad. And second, to further develop its nuclear weapons-related capabilities. That plan came directly from Iran's top leadership. Iran said to the agency that it had not conducted metallurgical work specifically designed for a nuclear device.
Well, that was Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. John Everard, how convincing was Netanyahu's evidence? Because it seemed like that was pretty long on rhetoric and maybe rather light on hard facts or real data, despite his impressive PowerPoint.
Yes, I nicely put, Tom. There's all kinds of, shall we say, areas of doubt. Firstly, Mossad removed half a ton of files from the Iran's most secret place. What were the Iranians doing? Sort of just, were they asleep at the time? I mean, this is so inherently improbable that I think a line or two just explaining how this miracle occurred wouldn't have gone amiss. How there are 100,000 documents in there? They've counted them? And they've actually read this lot? Come on. I mean, coming on also to, actually on that point, to the various comments we've had, these things have only been available to anybody for, what, 48 hours now? And people are commenting on them. Nobody has the remotest idea what is in that trove, if, in fact, it is a real trove and it's not a vast extension of what we come to call fake news. All we've got so far is a PowerPoint, Bibi Netanyahu, not always a symbol of veracity, standing in front of piles of what look like CDs and box files. The Iranians use box files for this stuff, he's claiming, smiling at the world and saying they lied. Come on.
What you miss in on radio is that moment when he pulled back the curtain, but because it was all surprisingly kind of low tech. I was kind of reminded of one of those Open University presentations in the 1970s. And yes, the language, as you hear it, is very dramatic. He had all the stats, all the facts, the figures, big writing saying Iran lied. And then the pictures that we saw of this supposed bunker, I mean, it was a room full of filing cabinets. It could have been anything. We didn't actually see any of the documents. But I think behind all of this is this fact that clearly he wants to make a point, just as the whole Iran nuclear deal is under question, with President Trump suggesting that when it comes to that next deadline coming up on May the 12th, he might not want to ratify the deal. And of course, whatever the doubts and the questions in that extraordinary presentation, President Trump has seized on it and said, oh, well, it shows I was 100% right when I said there were huge problems with this deal.
That sadly was predictable. That's the kind of thing that Donald Trump does. I mean, I said just now that Bibi Netanyahu is not always veracious. Donald Trump has the equal problem. He can't actually tell truth from falsehood. I was more disappointed that Mike Pompeo came out saying that. I thought better of him.
Well, indeed, and we'll come on to Trump again in a bit more detail. But, John, I guess just to sort of bore down in a bit more detail into some of the substance here, because it is worth pointing out, and actually Netanyahu, even in that clip we mentioned, talked about the mounting pressure on Iran back in 2003, of course. And a number of, well, I would hope more objective, independent analysts have suggested that actually, if you look to what the IAEA has had to say, there isn't really any evidence, certainly not in that presentation, of any substantive change since then. And we know that Iran even pivoted at that point to look at nuclear in more of a civic, an energy deployment point of view, rather than a weapon, in a sort of weapons direction. And this is over a decade ago. And some of those sources have sort of quietly spoken up and said, look, this does not move that on. That remains the backdrop. It's important to remember that.
Absolutely. And indeed, the French have come out and said that as far as they can tell, and of course, you know, they haven't read the 100,000 pages either, the evidence that's been produced is something the Europeans have known for nearly a decade now. This is not news. I mean, the Iranians either declared this or let it be known right at the beginning of the process. And the suggestion that this is in some way lying, cheating or falsifying evidence is being firmly rejected by the Europeans.
And interesting, I mean, not just the French, but the Germans, the UK Foreign Minister Alistair Burt has been insisting that they haven't seen anything that makes them feel that the Iran nuclear deal is undermined. And the IAEA itself, which of course is the body that is in place in order to check these sort of things, has been careful not to comment directly on Israel's claims, but it has pointed to what it said back at the start of this Iran nuclear deal in 2015, when it said there was no credible indication of activities in Iran relative to the development of a nuclear device after 2009. And today it has pointed back to that statement. The whole point of this Iran deal is that there are independent inspections in the country. I know that some people do have concerns that they are not rigorous enough, that they don't get quite the sufficient access that they should have. But there is no suggestion from anyone other than this presentation from Netanyahu that anything has changed dramatically since the verification process, which underpins that whole deal.
But just parsing the IAEA statement, the IAEA communicates in a rather strange language. Usually, if it's not sure of something, it comes out with a statement something like, no, we are studying this, or we have not yet had access to the full information. To come out with a statement pointing to previous statements, that in IAEA speak is a firm rebuttal.
Yes, it's as robust as they deal. Yeah. Let's look back to the US position. You were talking about Mike Pompeo a moment ago, John. And I guess what's interesting in particular here is to look at what the current US position, insofar as we can understand what it is, means for those other key stakeholders. If we look at some of those who were part of the P5+1, the UK, France, Carol just mentioned, where does US rhetoric and indeed Trump's position on this leave those other stakeholders in this?
In, frankly, a rather embarrassing position. I mean, it's very hard to hold this deal together if the United States walks away from it. And, here we are talking about global unity, united front and all this kind of thing. And there we get this out of the White House. Things, of course, not made any easier by the fact that the Iranians, a couple of hours ago, put out a statement saying that whatever the Americans do, they find that the deal is actually unsustainable and are thinking of leaving it anyway. At a time when Iran appears to be deploying military assets in Syria within range of Israel, this leaves me feeling just a little bit uncomfortable.
It is very difficult indeed for the Europeans. And we saw that extraordinary joint news conference with Emmanuel Macron of France with President Trump. Macron made it clear that he really wants the president to continue to back the deal. It seems as though the Europeans are trying to devise some sort of strategy that can somehow nudge President Trump to signing off on this deal, extending it for a further term, whilst agreeing with him that perhaps more features could be tacked on, perhaps more verification, perhaps some more immediate triggers for the reimposition of sanctions if there is evidence that Iran is not sticking to its side of the deal. But I think all those other European powers are well aware how difficult it is to influence this American president, how they need to tread very delicately, very diplomatically, because if they seem to be trying to push him around, President Trump would quite possibly decide to pull out of the deal. And as John was saying, that would, of course, jeopardise the whole thing, just as that whole area of the Middle East with the entanglement of Syria is in a very, very volatile situation.
Let's look close to home for the three of us here in London, at least. An immigration row here in the United Kingdom, known as the Windrush scandal, has already cost the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, her job. The new broom is Sajid Javid. The extraordinary decision by the Home Office to treat the children of long-term UK residents, many of them now of retirement age, as illegal immigrants, effectively, may serve as a valuable lesson to future governments tempted to perhaps overstep their responsibilities. But it will also no doubt have many policymakers around the world rethinking whether their own rules and regulations may venture, frankly, into, well, almost racist territories. Immigration policies always demand a delicate communication strategy. Here are some of the ways that world leaders have approached the topic before.
What we're saying is, look, an open, modern democracy like Britain, yes, we need migration, we benefit from migration, but that migration must be controlled. And one of the problems we've had in recent years is because we have created more jobs than the rest of the European Union put together, we've seen very high rates of migration.
We have very bad laws for our border. And we are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military.
I endorse my statements about Angela Merkel's decision, because I think when you speak about not just migrants, but refugees, you speak about people leaving their countries because of a political regime and because they are killed for political reasons. Refugees are part of our DNA.
For us, it's about putting our hands up and saying, for those who are bona fide refugees, who we screen to be bona fide refugees, we see that we have a role to play.
What the British people voted for on the 23rd of June was to bring some control into the movement of people from the European Union into the UK. A points-based system does not give you that control.
We have a proud record of welcoming people from 140 different nations. But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
Well, a whistle-stop world tour there. David Cameron from Britain, US President Donald Trump, French President Emmanuel Macron, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, British Prime Minister current Theresa May, and former Australian Prime Minister John Howard, of course, the man credited with establishing Australia's famously tough immigration policies. Carol Walker, an interesting mix, some similar rhetoric from all of those. The simple fact here is, though, controlled borders, well-controlled borders, do tend to win votes. That's certainly the direction of travel of late. How do you communicate that without stoking nationalist fervour, xenophobic, maybe even racist fervour?
To be honest, I think that certainly in the UK, that has been a really difficult struggle for politicians across all parties, certainly in the United Kingdom. And I think we have seen that come to a head with the Windrush scandal, which has been unfolding in the UK at the moment. For people who haven't got across that, the Windrush generation were people who were invited to the UK from Caribbean countries in the 60s and 70s. They had a legitimate right to be here. But when the government sought to clamp down on illegal immigration, they found themselves asked to produce documents for every year that they'd been here that many of them didn't have. And they were then, in some cases, they lost their jobs, they lost their livelihoods. In some cases, they were threatened with deportation. And it is this that has underpinned a huge political row and led to the resignation of the Home Secretary, who claimed she didn't have targets for removing illegal migrants when, in fact, they do. But I think to go back to this point about the language, I think it has proved very, very difficult. We heard from David Cameron there. undoubtedly one of the sentiments that fueled the vote for Brexit was a feeling amongst a certain part of the population that there was too much immigration, it was putting too much pressure on public services, on local housing, and that no one was controlling it. And I think perhaps one of the worst examples of a failure to differentiate between preying on those fears and addressing legitimate rights was when we saw that poster which the UKIP leader at the time, Nigel Farage, unveiled with the big words "breaking point." It showed a flood of what was actually refugees heading into Europe as an indication of the sorts of problems that Britain was going to face if it remained inside the European Union. That was undoubtedly intended to pander towards those who were essentially feeling resentful about the number of foreigners coming into the country. And I think that there was a concern amongst some of the others in the Leave campaign about the tone of that poster, but undoubtedly it played a part in delivering the Brexit vote.
And John, it's interesting to reflect, we did have that sort of global spread with those similar rhetorical devices used. One senses an increased use of this them versus us dynamic, the other as the scapegoat. Is this one of the new political realities alongside rising nationalism that we just need to get used to? That's a political device. It's a tool used by some unscrupulous politicians, but also maybe it's a socio-political reality that we just have to accept. That's going to characterise particularly elections, even in Western democracies.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's been a socio-political reality for actually quite a long time. The problem is that people have not wanted to talk about it. Mm. I mean, we know a lot more now about the way the societies react and behave amongst themselves than we did in the 1960s. And we know that if you introduce into almost any society significant numbers of people who are different, even in quite small ways, from that society, you get an abreaction. It's wrong to just call this racism. That is simply the way that human beings are built. And you have to accept that as a starting point in running an immigration policy. One of the interesting things about the experience of mass immigration from the Eastern European countries is that it shows that, in fact, this is not to do with race. That Poles coming to this country, a Pole walked along the street, you can't tell that they are different straight away. And yet, over time, the same kind of abreaction to the Polish presence has built up in large parts of the UK, as was a problem in the 60s and 70s at a time of high black immigration from the Caribbean. It's a complex phenomenon. I mean, you can like it or you can dislike it, but it's there and you have to take account of it.
And indeed, we've seen in many places right across Europe the rise in popularity of populist right-wing leaders who have really talked up their desire to get a grip on immigration. Look at what's happened in Hungary, in Austria, Germany, where Angela Merkel faced something of a backlash when she opened her arms and opened the doors to large numbers of refugees. Even in places like Sweden, there is now a big problem of resentment between different communities. And I think John is absolutely right that this is something that the UK has struggled to get grips with, but it is something that is a much wider phenomenon and which we've seen characterised and being played out in the politics of a lot of Western European countries.
Hugely challenging and very complex, undoubtedly, but I guess it is the job of the Home Office and its respective counterparts in other countries to tackle this nevertheless. And one thing, John, strikes me as interesting. If we go back to, and obviously the recent anniversary of the Stephen Lawrence murder has prompted this thought, definitions from the McPherson report, of course, at that time about what constitutes institutional racism within a body. And I thought this was interesting, and I slightly paraphrase here. In that inquiry was this description: a collective failure of an institution to deliver appropriate or professional service to people because of their colour, culture, or ethnic origin. Now, that could be applied pretty explicitly to the way that the Home Office here in the UK has dealt with the Windrush scandal. So, what was institutional racism in the Met? Is that not strikingly similar within the Home Office?
We just don't know, because we actually, through all this noise and thunder, don't know why it is that the Home Office took these steps on the Windrush immigrants. The fact that they destroyed the records a couple of years ago is obviously significant. They've claimed that they're just tidying up. And, you know, I've worked in a bureaucracy. These things happen. But the fact that the records weren't there and therefore nobody could prove that, you know, they had a legitimate right, of course, has caused absolute chaos. Mm. Remember that the intention at the time was that the Windrush generation should stay. I mean, they were given permanent residency, and they were actually sort of welcomed in. And I'm pretty sure that when Theresa May was talking about a hostile environment for illegal immigrants, she didn't mean them.
Well, but there's the rub, I guess. If you use rhetoric like that, and we sort of come back to where we started this segment, Carol, isn't it? Can you talk about borders, control, inhospitable environments, acting tough? Can you pursue those aims? Can you fixate? Can you use that language? And not at least predict that it's a possibility that things that can then be construed as xenophobic or racist are going to happen.
Well, I think you need a bit of efficiency in the system, and I think that was part of the problem here. John talked about the way that the landing cards of some of the Windrush generation were simply chucked out when they moved out of a particular office in Croydon because nobody thought they were needed anymore. It does seem extraordinary now to think, well, surely somebody might have considered that those might have been important to keep. But I think the problem is that if you have that sort of rhetoric and you then have, as we had in the Home Office, targets that were set to increase the number of deportations of illegal immigrants. Yes, no one intended this to scoop up people from the Windrush generation who were perfectly entitled to be in this country. But if you have a slightly chaotic department, officials are under pressure to try and get the numbers up. And a new regime which requires, for example, landlords to check the immigration status of people who want to rent a place, employers to check, as was one suggestion, which was then dropped, the ethnic backgrounds of some of their employees, then you get these unintended consequences. And you do get anyone who has an origin outside the country feeling that they are being targeted. And when you have a country like the UK, which has a colonial past, that further complicates the feelings and adds to the likelihood of feelings of resentment and black and Middle Eastern communities feeling that they are being targeted.
It's a sobering thought indeed, if we should hope that these institutions are incompetent or inefficient rather than institutionally racist. But I guess you've got to seek solace where you can. Let's move on. We've all likely been in the difficult position of planning a dinner date for some particularly demanding guests. But whatever your party planning peril, it surely pales in comparison to the challenge of preparing for a summit between the leaders of North Korea and the United States. John Everard, we have to start with you with this. Plenty of locations have popped up in discussions. Could it be Beijing? Could Helsinki host this? Is Singapore the spot? The DMZ, of course, has been thrown into the mix more recently as a rather perhaps predictable location. How do you assess the likelihood? Who are the runners and riders in your well-trained view?
Well, I don't know about who being well-trained, but we know that they are considering five possible locations. Trump mentioned this, a couple of days ago. And he's just asked everybody in a tweet, extraordinarily, whether they think that the DMZ is the right place. It's got to the stage where the President of the United States asked the world in general where to hold his summit. Hey. We also know that Singapore is under consideration, again, because Trump mentioned that. Where the other three are, we don't know, but we can guess. I suspect that Beijing is in there somewhere. Probably Ulaanbaatar, as neutral, reasonably convenient for everybody concerned, and the kind of country that's not going to cause too many problems. One other, hey, maybe Thailand. Remember that in one version of the messages that Kim Jong-un was sending Trump at the beginning of all this process through the South Koreans, he apparently offered to travel to Washington, D.C. if necessary. So just possibly thinking of that. And are they thinking of Pyongyang? I mean, I think the North Koreans would love that. But I suspect that a lot of people in the White House would kind of throw themselves across to Donald Trump and say, Mr. President, please, no, no, not Pyongyang.
Carol, it's interesting. I guess you reflect back to the sort of the dark days of the height of the Cold War when we saw meetings happen, either clandestine ones or very public ones in places like Helsinki, in Reykjavik. This is more complicated. And apparently one of the factors of consideration is that North Koreans' facility to actually fly great distances. Their jets aren't super efficient. So it might need to be a bit closer to home. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating. And I would have thought Donald Trump, he won't really want to do the North-South Korea border because the two Korean leaders have already kind of done that one with their pretty dramatic photo opportunities as they step from one side of the border to the other. I was interested in John's idea, who's obviously got a far greater insight into the way that the Koreans might look at this than I do. But he talked about a neutral territory, Ulaanbaatar. I wondered whether they should take them right out of the region to somewhere completely neutral. I mean, Geneva has a great history. It's in a neutral country. It's got the beautiful lake. I think these summits, of course, there is hugely important politics to be discussed. But the other key thing is to establish some sort of rapport between two leaders who have been so far apart for so long. So maybe a little walk by a Swiss lake. The Swiss would presumably be quite well geared up to making sure that it worked pretty efficiently. They could deal with security and so on. Might be a long way for them to go. But maybe if they didn't like that, I was thinking that we know that President Trump likes a bit of ceremony, a bit of grandeur. He's got a pretty good buddy in Emmanuel Macron now. So maybe they could borrow Versailles and then they would have a really grand setting. They could wander around the grounds. It has a fantastic history. You could get a French chef to rustle up some fantastic combination of cold noodles and hamburgers with some fine wine, and maybe that would lubricate the wheels of peace.
Lots of mirrors in there, which I'm sure President Trump would go for. In a word, John, if Ambassador Everard were to be hosting this, where would he choose?
I would probably go for Singapore.
Okay, good choice. I like it. Now, we're going to end the show with, well, frankly, a bit of a song and dance. Not from John and Carol. Courtesy instead, maybe the programme is young, but courtesy of the CEO of Sainsbury's supermarket chain, Mike Coop.
Women, money, the sky is sunny. Let's send it rolling along. We're in the money, the sky is sunny. Let's lend it, spend it, send it rolling along.
I feel almost bad, especially playing the refrain. The somewhat questionable musical talents there of Mike Coop. That was, we're told, a classic hot mic moment. Caught in between interviews, Coop explained that he'd recently seen 42nd Street, playing in the West End, of course, and the impromptu performance had no connection whatsoever to a planned merger that will turn Sainsbury's and rival supermarket Asda into a mega retailer with £50 billion plus in revenues. Carol Walker, do you buy the unfortunate Mike Coop's explanation that this was just something he had in his head?
Well, I think it's very unfortunate for Mike Coop because he's been going around saying, well, this merger, it's all about a good deal for the customers and the consumers, and it's going to reduce prices. But I think that he had something else on his mind there, and I think that was a Freudian slip.
It could have been worse, I guess, John. Money, Money, Money by ABBA. I don't know if that's one of your favourites. It could have been more explicit. Do you have a sort of favourite of these sort of hot mic moments when, I don't know, a leader or a business person is inadvertently or advertently caught on tape?
Not quite a hot mic moment. My favourite of the genre goes way back on Chinese television, live Chinese television, about 20 years ago, where the governor of Sichuan province announced to the waiting Chinese nation the construction of the Three Gorges Dam, of course, a huge construction project. And he stood in front of the cameras and said, and so we see that the revolutionary Chinese masses have finally defeated the forces of nature. And just that moment, a passing bird dropped a huge right on his forehead.
That takes some beauty. My personal favourite is at a treaty signing, Czech President Václav Klaus. I don't know if you know this one, John. He was signing alongside his Chilean counterpart, Sebastian Piñera. And Václav Klaus took rather a shine to the fancy pen that he'd been given to sign this deal, and then sort of basically pocketed it out, as he thought, out of shot, and he was vilified on social media and all the rest. Carol, in short, it's a reminder you've got to watch what you're saying.
I can think of so many. I remember very vividly the moment when David Cameron, having lost the referendum, decided to quit, walks back into number 10 Downing Street, and the cameras picked him up saying, you might have thought he was devastated, but he was a man walking away from the pressures of a prime ministerial life to pastures anew. There are so many. He'd already let slip in a quick chat to the former mayor of New York, Mike Bloomberg, that the Queen purred down the phone when she heard the result of the Scottish referendum. And of course, you're not supposed to say what the Queen has told you when you're the Prime Minister. There are so many, but I know I've got to stop.
There we go. Carol Walker, John Everard, wonderful to have you with us. As always, here on Midori House, today's programme was produced by Ben Ryland, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My thanks to them all. Do join us at the same time tomorrow.
Women, money, the sky is sunny. Let's send it, lend it, lend it, lend it.